Here in the United States, we have great fond memories and great reverence for a fellow by the name of the Marquis de Lafayette. You know, that French guy who showed up during the American Revolution and helped George Washington kick the British out at Yorktown. Do the French have a similar attitude toward him? I mean, they should, shouldn't they? He's a hero here, he should be a hero there. Well, Laura Arricchio has done the research, and she tells us that attitudes toward Lafayette are very different depending on which side of the pond you are on. And she went over there and she spoke to some French folks about it, and then she wrote a book. It's your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week it's all about Lafayette Reconsidered.
Your weekly constitutional is produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier. Your host is Professor of Constitutional Law, Stuart Harris.
The Marquis de Lafayette is one of those guys you hear about back in your history class when you were in junior high school. In fact, I remember pretty vividly we had one of those old films with those really tinny sort of soundtracks, and they quoted General Black Jack Pershing showing up at the beginning of World War I, or at least the beginning of World War I for the United States, with the phrase, "Lafayette, we are here." Well, that was actually a misattribution. But the point is that the United States has long felt very, very grateful to the French for French assistance during the American Revolution, and grateful enough so that when Pershing went over in World War I to help the French fight off the Germans who were invading their country at that time, he made that reference. We're here. We've got your back because you had our back when we needed you. So this French-American alliance goes back a long, long way, and it's extremely important in American history, and we still have a great, wonderful feeling for Lafayette in this country. There are lots and lots of places that are named after Lafayette, and so I thought it was a good time to revisit this, or actually to visit it for the first time. We've never really talked about Lafayette in this show. And by happy coincidence, I came across a book that was recently published by a woman named Laura Arricchio. And Laura's just a delightful lady, as you'll hear in just a moment. And she is a dean at the New School in New York City. And she got interested in Lafayette some time ago. She branched out from her primary interest in art history and got interested in particularly Lafayette. She started doing some research, and it turns out that attitudes toward Lafayette in the United States and in France are very, very different.
My name is Laura Arricchio, and I'm a dean at the New School in New York City. Now, we're actually not such a new university. We were founded in 1919.
Good heavens. Well, we can't leave that then. What is the story there? Why is it called the New School?
The New School was founded in 1919 by a bunch of educational reformers, including John Dewey and others, who were actually leaving Columbia University. And they wanted to create a new kind of education that would be for adults, that was not necessarily walled off from the city the way that a lot of universities and colleges are, but that was really meant to serve lifelong learning. And so we actually, our first degree programs were actually PhD programs for adults, and then our next degree programs were for adults returning to school. And now we're a full-fledged university, 10,000 students. Parsons School of Design is our art school.
I've heard of that.
Not so new anymore.
No, you're not. But it's always due when you're willing to look into new ideas and take a new perspective, right?
Exactly. And that's how we think of things here.
Tremendous. And you're the dean of the whole place.
No, I'm the dean of one portion of the place, of one of the schools of the New School. We're a pretty big institution, so...
Well, I'm still...
There's a bunch of deans. We're sort of a dime a dozen.
Nah, I'm still impressed. That's very, 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 very nice. Okay, now we know who you are, but we don't know much about you. What do you generally write about? I know that you write books. What do you generally write about?
Yeah, so I'm actually a specialist in 18th century French history and art history. So I mostly work in the Age of Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, I've branched out from France to looking at France and America in the Age of Revolution. So... Mm-hmm. Both the American Revolution, the French Revolution, and then the many, many revolutions they had in France after that in the 19th century.
So what particularly got you interested in writing this book about Lafayette?
Well, I actually became interested in Lafayette while I was working on one of those art books that you mentioned. Mm-hmm. I was working on a woman artist, actually, from the age of the French Revolution. And there was a painting by her that was called The Portrait of the Marquise de Lafayette. It was called The Portrait of Lafayette's Wife. Long story, turns out it was not a portrait of Lafayette's wife, but in the process of doing the research about that portrait, I just became incredibly interested in Lafayette. And being an art historian, the way that I started to go about researching Lafayette was that I started to go around and look at all the artworks that have been made about him, because, you know, there's a ton. Here in Manhattan alone, I think there's two sculptures of Lafayette that I know of in Manhattan alone, and there's certainly more all over the country. So I made an appointment to see a sculpture of Lafayette that's at Versailles. And I went to see this sculpture, and I got there, and I had to make this special appointment with the curator. And it turns out that the curator was not necessarily overjoyed to see me.
Is that just a French thing? I mean, just another...
Oh, well, that could be.
You're just an American showing up, and another American wants to look at our museums.
That's entirely possible, and okay. That was certainly probably part of the story. But the other part was that apparently, and I didn't know this in advance, in order for him to show me this sculpture, he had to dig out this old set of sort of antique keys that hadn't been used in quite some time. And then we had to hike outside of the building and walk quite a ways in the rain because the sculpture, which I figured would be, you know, I figured it would be one of the highlights of the museum, was actually in the sort of outbuilding in a room that nobody had gone to for quite some time. And when
So Lafayette's in a storage closet?
Basically, and not so much a storage closet, but definitely a room that by the time we found it and turned on the light, we realized there was kind of a fine film of dust all over it. So it was clearly not one of the more popular places at Versailles.
That must have been striking. Okay, go on, please.
Well, so we got there, and we're looking at the sculpture, and all of a sudden the curator says to me, "Why should we have a bust of Lafayette?" Now, he said it in French, so I assumed that I had misheard him. So I said, pardon? And he did what people do when they're talking to somebody in a foreign language. He just repeated the question slower and louder.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "Why should we have a bust of Lafayette?" So I started to tell him, and I started to say, well, you know, Lafayette was only 19 years old when he joined General Washington's army. He was one of the wealthiest men in France, and yet he chose to come over here of his own expense. He froze with our men at Valley Forge. And Lafayette was very influential in terms of persuading the French monarchy to come out in open support of the American Revolution. And I was telling him all of this, and he was decidedly unimpressed. And he gestured to a plaque that was installed a few feet away. And it was a plaque that was commemorating the thousands of French soldiers and sailors who had fought in the American Revolution, many of whom had died. And he said, you know, you don't know any of their names. On top of which, he said, Rochambeau, not Lafayette, was the head of the French forces. No Americans worship Rochambeau. I mean, that's not true. Some Americans like Rochambeau, but it's true that he's nowhere near the household name that Lafayette is. And then he said, and finally, he said, Louis XVI, the king of France, he bankrupted the country for your revolution, and he got his thanks on the guillotine. Nobody has a sculpture of him.
Hmm.
So why, of all the Frenchmen, do Americans adore Lafayette?
That's a pretty good question, isn't it?
Yeah, and so that's the question that I really set out to answer, was the question of why is it that we do adore Lafayette above all others, and also, why is it that the French really do not? Because the other thing I discovered was that Lafayette's reputation in France is actually much more complicated, and he is not considered a universal hero in France the way that he is here.
Well, Laura, you have now whetted my appetite thoroughly, and so let's start at the beginning. Tell us all about this mysterious character with two such different reputations across the Atlantic.
Well, you know, I think the first thing that I learned about him that surprised me was that he came to America like a lot of immigrants before and a lot of immigrants since. He came to America in part to reinvent himself. Now, that might seem surprising because, as I said, he was an aristocrat and he was one of France's wealthiest men. However, it turns out that he was actually something of an outsider at the court of Versailles. He was not from the most sophisticated echelons of French society. He came from the countryside. He came from an area called the Auvergne, which is in the south central France. And he had a sort of rustic sensibility. He had a very honest and open and forthright manner. And he, through a series of circumstances, found himself married into one of the most influential families at the court of Versailles. So what that meant was this kid, he was a teenager, this kid from the provinces, from the countryside, who had dreamed all of his life of military glory, suddenly found himself at age 17 married into a world that was for him sort of like a gilded cage. He was expected to know how to dance properly and how to ride a horse like a gentleman, and he actually didn't have any of these skills because he hadn't been raised in that society. And not only didn't he have the skills, they didn't want those skills because these were not things that he valued. He thought they were all inglorious, and he wanted to make a difference in this world.
It sounds almost like Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
Yeah.
You know, French version, 18th century version.
So yeah,
he's a young idealist from the provinces.
That's exactly right. Young, idealist, naive, burning with enthusiasm, and really looking for a cause.
And I don't know a lot about the court at Versailles, but I'm guessing it was very sophisticated, very cynical, and not the sort of place where idealists were welcome.
That's exactly right. An idealist didn't usually last very long in mm-hmm. this kind of world. Nonetheless, this is the world that his in-laws wanted him to belong to.
Mm-hmm.
So his in-laws actually attempted to place him in the entourage of the king's brother. They wanted to place him in some circumstance where he'd have some sort of position in the retinue of the king's brother. But he really was dreaming only of military glory, and so what he did was he actually insulted the king's brother.
Oh, good heavens.
At a masquerade ball. And he did this, he said, in order to spare himself this kind of life. And it worked because that put an end to his career at court.
Oh, my God. You know, this isn't Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. This is Ned Stark Goes to King's Landing. This is Game of Thrones. This is the guy who lives way off in the sticks, who wants to do the right thing. He shows up, he gets impatient with all the machinations at court, and ends up making people angry at him.
You know, I think that might actually be exactly right. And
okay.
I suspect Game of Thrones might have been based on Lafayette rather than the other way around.
I suspect so, exactly. But I was looking for that modern point of reference. Very, very interesting. Okay, now I've got a mental image. In fact, if he'd stuck around there, maybe things would have gone very, very poorly for him. But obviously he didn't stick around there forever because he found his cause, didn't he?
That's exactly right. So the other coincidence was that he... you know, his father had actually been killed in the Seven Years' War. His father had been killed in what we call here the French and Indian War.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd been killed by an English cannonball. And Lafayette always dreamed that he would follow in his father's footsteps and maybe get revenge against the English, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So he was rising through the ranks of the army in the way that one did in those days, which was through wealth and connections. You sort of bought your way up the French army.
Mm-hmm.
But as it happened in the spring of 1776, the French army was undergoing a series of reforms so that all of the officers, men like Lafayette, who had no battlefield experience but who had nonetheless risen through the ranks, all found themselves placed in the army reserve. And this happened in the spring of 1776. So it was in July of 1776 when Lafayette had no career ahead of him in the army, had no career ahead of him at court, when all of a sudden into Paris arrived a group of Americans, Silas Deane and some others, who were there looking to drum up support for the American cause.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm having a perfectly delightful conversation with Laura Arricchio, who is a dean at the New School in New York City and who's just recently written a book called The Marquis, Lafayette Reconsidered. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and talk some more with Laura Arricchio. So stick around. We'll be right back.
Turbo. Turbo is written on the side of what looks like a really hot little Porsche.
They're Hot Wheels.
This is a big Hot Wheels. This is like three times the size of the Hot Wheels I played with.
Yeah.
Because I played with my Hot Wheels back in the early 70s, and I'm guessing these are from...
Well, we're going to talk about a Texas case.
Okay, but no, this is your car, isn't it?
Well, that's not the one I drove here.
It's not the one you drove, but it's the one...
Mark, do you think I could fit into that?
I don't think... None of the three of us could fit into this car. It's about, what, about 5 inches long?
That is one of my toys from when I was a child.
Right, and so I'm saying this is a Hot Wheels car from which decade?
Oh, the 70s.
The 70s, really?
It's true.
Yeah, I knew you were almost as old as I am. No, this is just a bigger Hot Wheels, but it's a very nifty-looking little Porsche, and the door's open.
Oh, yeah.
Door's open.
My kids love that.
Exactly right. Okay, and that has something to do, I'm sure, with this quiz today.
Well, it's bigger than most cars because we're going to be talking about a Texas case that recently came before the Supreme Court.
Oh, I think I know where you're going with this one, but before we do the quiz, we need to have a contestant. So is there someone on the line?
Yes, there is.
Tremendous. And what is your name, sir?
My name is Reese Brassler.
And where are you from, Reese?
Nashville, Tennessee.
Nashville, Tennessee. What a fine place. Are you a musician?
I am not a musician.
Okay, well.
Well, you know, want to be a musician, but, you know, not necessarily skilled musician.
You know, I think there are a lot of people in that category.
Yeah, that's most of Nashville, I think.
And most
more
of
than
LA.
Like to admit it.
All right. Are you ready for a quiz, Reese?
Yes, I'm ready.
Okay, Doug.
All right, Reese, I'm going to ask you a question and give you four choices here. Are you ready?
I am ready.
The Supreme Court recently ruled on a freedom of speech case dealing with what on automobiles? Was it A, bumper stickers claiming the end of the world is upon us?
Mm.
B, furry stuffed animals blocking your view in the back window?
Mm.
C, state-issued license plates? Or D, spiked lug nuts resembling something out of a James Bond movie?
Goldfinger.
I'm going to go with C, state-issued license plates.
You went straight to C. You didn't want to talk about Goldfinger lug nuts.
Well,
didn't want to talk about stuffed animals.
The furry
or the end
animal
of the world.
Was the one that had me thinking, honestly. But
that's speech, right?
Yeah,
if I put my furry panda bear in the
sure.
back, right?
What now?
That's speech. If I put my furry panda bear back in my back window, I'm proclaiming to the world that I love furry panda bears.
This is true. I'm not sure how many people would be offended by the type of furry animal you put back there, but...
Okay.
Yeah, but maybe the question is whether the state can tell you you can't put a furry animal back there.
Oh, yeah. I think that would be. That would be the case. But that's not what Reese completely gravitated to. Reese, why are you gravitating toward a license plate so rapidly?
Well, it seems, one, to be the most reasonable, and two, I know about this case.
So. Oh, what case is it?
I don't know the exact name of the case. I know that there's somebody in Texas challenged. They wanted a state-issued license tag with the Confederate flag on it, and they said that it wasn't unconstitutional for the state to not allow that.
We have an expert on the phone, don't we, Doug?
We do. That was
the correct answer.
You got it. It is C, in fact. It is a state-issued license plate.
Yes, and it's got a great name. The case is a great name. Every time I see it, I think Walker, Texas Ranger.
I know, it's Walker v. Texas Division of the Sons of the Confederate.
Exactly right.
Veterans.
So what was the issue here, Doug?
The issue was that the Sons of the Confederate Veterans in Texas, they really wanted their own Confederate license plate. And the state of Texas said, no, we're not going to have a specialty plate. Now, it's interesting to note that there's over 350 specialty plates in Texas, including like Dr. Pepper mm-hmm. has a plate, Mighty Fine Burgers has a plate.
Mighty Fine Burgers.
But the legislature in Texas said they chose not to have a Confederate States plate. And the Sons of the Confederate Veterans really called a question of that because they said that the state was, in fact, by not issuing these plates, they were blocking their speech.
Right. This is a fascinating topic and a fairly complex one, so I'll say right off the bat that we recently did an episode, and I think it was called Nazis, Confederates, and Government Speech, and it was all about the Walker case, and I had a really lengthy and really geeked-out conversation with a good friend of mine, Doug McKechnie, who's really into this stuff, and it's a far more nuanced decision than one would think, and I'll simply try to summarize it this way. The question boils down to this. whose speech is on that plate? Mm-hmm. Is that me, the driver, who goes out and buys a vanity plate, or is it the government that's speaking? And there's a concept called hybrid speech, where there's a combination of government and private speech. And the general rule is that private speech is protected by the First Amendment, but the government speech is not. Government speech is not an individual right. It's a power of government. And so it really boiled down to that. Is a court going to call this more government, or is it going to call it more individual? And they came down and said it's more government speech.
It's government speech.
Right.
That's right.
And I think they made the point. You can put any bumper sticker you want on your car, but if you want to sort of enlist the government to in some sense, join your statement, whatever that statement is, by putting a Confederate flag on your car, the government has the option of either doing that or not. Mm-hmm. And that's the theory. Now, there's still troubling questions there. There's still troubling questions because that now the government's effectively in a position, at least in that little bit of real estate on your car, of saying, yes, this speech is okay. You know, the Mighty Burgers are okay.
Yep.
But the Confederate flag is not. And whenever the government's involved in saying this speech is okay and that speech is not, it's troubling, even if the First Amendment doesn't apply.
Yeah, it gets tricky. What Justice Breyer wrote in the majority opinion is, quote, just as Texas cannot force a private citizen to convey on his or her license plate a message with which he or she doesn't agree, so the sons of Confederate veterans cannot force Texas to convey on its license plate a message with which the state does not agree.
Yep.
And I think what you're pointing out is a good one, which is at what point does the state agree with one message over another?
Exactly. And the court was very clear on that. They're trying, the sons of Confederate veterans, at least a lot of people perceived that they were trying to legitimize their message mm-hmm. by getting the state to go along with them. And the state simply said no. And the state has the power to do that. Wow, fascinating case. Lots and lots of fallout from that one, I'm sure, in the future. Lots of states are going to be very happy because they make tons of money
sure.
off of those. And if this case had gone the other way, if states had lost the ability to control the messages they put on their plates, a lot of states would have simply opted out. And that's why we called the episode Nazis, Confederates, and Government Speech. Next week, it's the American Nazi Party. Next week, it's the Ku Klux Klan or some other objectionable group. And the states would then have a choice. Either we stop issuing these vanity plates or we let everybody put stuff on there.
That's right. That's
okay.
Right.
Well, thank you very much, Reese. You got it. You got a T-shirt. So send us an email at ywc@montpelier.org. Give us your T-shirt size and we'll put one in the snail mail to you along with your pocket constitution from James Madison's Montpelier.
That's awesome. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And thank you, Doug.
Hey, you bet, Stuart. It's the Constitution. I read it for the articles.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harrison. I'm speaking with author and dean of the New School, Laura Arricchio, about her recent book, The Marquis, Lafayette Reconsidered. We're talking about that Lafayette fellow, the fellow who showed up and helped George Washington. But before he did that, why did he do that? Why did he leave his native France and come over to join our revolution? Well, before the break, Laura was telling me that he was a rich guy who was looking for martial glory, and he wasn't finding many opportunities in France. In fact, he was having some difficulty in the French army, and then a bunch of Americans arrived.
He met them immediately, and he was completely taken with them. In fact, all of Paris was taken with them. The Americans were all the rage in Paris in 1776. There was a card game. You know, there's an English card game that's called Whist. Mm-hmm. They renamed it Le Boston in honor of the Americans.
Right. Now, you didn't mention Benjamin Franklin. Wasn't he there yet?
Well, Benjamin, he had not arrived yet, but mm-hmm. when he arrived just a couple of months later, then America was absolutely the thing that everybody wanted to have a piece of. There were portraits of Benjamin Franklin above every mantelpiece in the highest society of Paris. And Marie Antoinette, in fact, wanted to get Narragansett horses for her stables because America was so fashionable.
Well, you know, that's very interesting you should say it that way, fashionable. Was this just a fashion? Was it just another fad that was embraced by a bunch of bored, rich people looking for diversion? Or was there some other reason that a bunch of aristocrats would embrace a revolution that was more republican in its leanings?
So these are all really excellent questions, and I think that the answer varies by individual. So there were some French officers who had been removed from the army who simply saw this as a way to get back into their careers. Some saw it as a way to gain revenge against England. Some actually believed, and Lafayette does not fall into any of these categories necessarily at all, but there were some who actually believed that the Americans were going to lose on their own and that what they really needed was a good bit of French know-how.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were some Frenchmen, who wanted to come over here and thought that they could teach George Washington a thing or two. Now, for Lafayette, none of these things is exactly the case. For Lafayette, this was an opportunity to strike a blow against England, for sure, but also to win back that possibility of a glorious life, of making a difference, and of striking a blow on behalf of humanity. Now, the idea that a republic could exist in America was something that was actually very appealing to a lot of French aristocrats.
Laura. That's the part I don't understand. I understand all these other baser motives, okay? I understand careerism. I understand glory. I understand revenge against the English. I don't understand why a bunch of French aristocrats would embrace the ideals of the American Revolution. And I've always thought it was just Benjamin Franklin's remarkable charm. But that doesn't seem to me to be an adequate explanation. Why would they embrace these ideals?
Well, actually, it's an interesting question. If you think about where we got our ideals from, a lot of them came from the French Enlightenment.
Well, they certainly did, and, you know, Montesquieu and all that good stuff, but, you mean, these aristocrats were actually believing that stuff. They're actually reading these books and buying into them.
That's exactly right. And I think that the appeal of America was as a new world where any kind of political experiment might be possible. I don't think they saw it as dangerous. I think they saw it as a place, a utopian place, where these Enlightenment ideals of Montesquieu and others, notions of liberty and freedom, could actually be tried out on a new ground. And I actually don't think that they thought that it might then someday turn around and change things in their hometowns as well.
I guess maybe the Atlantic Ocean gave them some comfort. It's always much easier to be in favor of revolution or even reform in some distant land.
I think that's absolutely right. But so Lafayette, unlike many of his colleagues, so to be honest, a lot of Frenchmen were coming over here, and the French government was looking the other way, while many soldiers and sailors and arms and ammunition, clothing, money was coming over here. But the French government was not yet ready in 1776 to come out in open support of the American Revolution. They were happy to do what they could to sort of help to deprive England of her colonies, but they were not yet ready to break their truce with England. And so they did not want Lafayette or others who were very closely affiliated with court to come over here. But Lafayette was an orphan, and he was a very wealthy orphan, and he essentially had nothing to lose. So he bought his own ship, and he came over under his own steam, and he stunned everybody.
Well, I guess that's one of the advantages of money.
You know,
you often hear about these people who win the lottery and it ruins their lives, but I've always thought that I would make a very good lottery winner. And apparently, that's what happened with Lafayette. He sort of won the lottery when he married into this remarkably rich family.
Well, actually, it was an interesting thing. It was his family that had the money.
Oh.
What his in-laws had was a connection. So that's how it came to pass that a country bumpkin, as it were, ended up married into such a wealthy family. Because he had the money and they had the connections.
I see. Okay. Well, so, but he won the lottery in terms of being born into the right family then.
That's exactly right. His family had sort of developed a habit of marrying well and dying young, mm-hmm. so that he ended up a very wealthy orphan.
Why couldn't my parents do that? Well, I'm sorry, Mom and Dad. My mom and dad are still around. Now, they're great people. But, man, that would be really awfully nice to have that much money that you could then simply put it toward the purchase of a ship and imagine and paying for the crew and equipping them and all of that other good stuff.
Yep, and coming over here under his own steam. Now, when he got here, to be honest, George Washington was not entirely sure what to do with him.
Mm-hmm.
Because George Washington had seen a lot of Frenchmen coming over, and George Washington had not been all that impressed with a lot of them.
Right.
He thought that some of them wanted his job, for instance.
And a lot of them probably fell into that category that you were talking about, the guys who'd been cashiered into the reserves because all they were was rich, so they weren't competent.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. Exactly right. So Washington was not necessarily thrilled to see another one of them coming over. In fact, he has this wonderful letter that he wrote to Congress when Lafayette arrived, where Washington writes and says, "What I am to do with the Marquis de Lafayette, I know no more than the child unborn. And in particular, the quandary he found himself in was that Lafayette had been granted a very high rank. He'd been granted the rank of Major General, but he had never seen a day of battlefield action. Now, Washington assumed that this was merely an honorary rank, but Lafayette was 19, and he was enthusiastic, and he was certain that he could do anything if he put his mind to it, and he wanted to be placed in command right then and there.
So what did Washington do?
Actually, Benjamin Franklin comes into the story.
Okay.
Benjamin Franklin wrote to Washington and said, when Lafayette gets there, do me a favor. He said, Lafayette is very wealthy, and he's very well connected. And all he wants, thought Franklin, all Lafayette wants, said Franklin, is just a bit of glory. So he asked Washington to find an opportunity where Lafayette could be hazarded not much, that's his quote, hazarded not much, but given an opportunity to make a name for himself so that he could then win some glory, go back home, and then boost the cause back in France. Well, Washington thought that just such a moment was at hand. This was in September of 1777, and the British were marching towards Philadelphia. And Washington knew that the battle was coming up on the Brandywine River on September 11th of 1777. And so he thought this was a good opportunity to place Lafayette on the battlefield, but he placed Lafayette in an area of the battlefield where he did not expect the British to be coming. He expected that Lafayette would be in an area that was going to be pretty darn safe. Well, as it happened, the British surprised Washington, and Lafayette ended up in the thick of the action. And as Lafayette remembered it, many of the other troops were retreating, but Lafayette was rallying the troops to stay on the battlefield when he got shot in the leg.
Mm-hmm.
So Lafayette was carried off the battlefield in Brandywine in September of 1777 with his boot filling with blood. And Washington immediately gave him over to the care of his own personal surgeon. Still, Washington imagined that all Lafayette wanted was this moment of glory. And so what Washington did was he actually inaugurated that glory by sending a missive that went into all the Patriot papers that described the Battle of Brandywine, saying that Lafayette, the Marquis de Lafayette, had been wounded in the leg. Now, again, Washington thought that Lafayette would heal and go home. But Lafayette had not come here just to do that. So instead, while he was recovering, and he recovered with the Moravian Brethren in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, while he was recovering, he decided that, well, if he couldn't fight for a few weeks, he was going to make himself useful in some other way. So he started writing letters. And then he started writing letters to the French saying, don't believe what you're hearing. The Americans are going to win this thing. Things are going great over here. Then he started writing letters to the Americans saying, the French are going to be here any day now. Don't believe anything that you hear about French having doubts. The French are going to come out any moment. And he put himself to use, making himself the sort of embodiment of this alliance between France and America, which he essentially kind of willed into being.
That is extraordinary. On the one hand, I'm guessing that Washington was very concerned about all of this independent action. On the other hand, it seems to have worked out pretty well, didn't it?
It sure did. And to be honest, Washington, I think, was really impressed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Washington, as you had said, many of the French aristocrats at the court of Versailles were folks who were, scheming, who were they kept their cards close to their chest. For Washington to say that Lafayette was actually earnest, open, enthusiastic, genuinely committed to making a difference, Washington from then on took Lafayette under his wing. And he decided that this was a young man who, yes, needed a bit of mentoring, but who, with a bit of mentoring, actually had great potential. And Lafayette and Washington developed a bond that many people have described as a father-son relationship. And it's really true.
Very interesting. So once Lafayette had healed, what did Washington ask him to do next?
Washington brought him with him to Valley Forge and placed him in command. He had his ups and downs at the start, as anyone might in a military command. But Washington really made it a point to give Lafayette very careful instructions, very careful guidelines, to cheer him on when things were going badly. And he really helped Lafayette turn from a sort of enthusiastic, sometimes a bit maybe sometimes his enthusiasm got the better of him. Mm-hmm. But Washington really trained him to become a really calm, intelligent, and clever military strategist. And that role is something that really played a hugely important role when Lafayette was fighting in Virginia during the Virginia campaign in 1781. And Lafayette went on to play a very important role then in the siege of Yorktown, which was the final hostilities of the American Revolution.
You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm talking to author Laura Arricchio about her recent book, The Marquis, Lafayette Reconsidered. After the break, we'll finish that conversation and hear about what happened to Lafayette after the American Revolution. So stay tuned. Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to finish our fascinating conversation with Laura Arricchio, all about her new book, The Marquis, Lafayette Reconsidered. You mentioned something, a father-son relationship, and I have heard of a similar relationship developing between Washington and Alexander Hamilton.
Yes.
And Alexander Hamilton was equally ambitious and idealistic and was chomping at the bit during this time to get a battlefield commission. And he didn't get one. I'm just going to guess, there was a little bit of jealousy between old Alex and the Marquis de Lafayette.
You know, it's actually interesting. They were very, very close. They were both very young. Mm-hmm. And as you say, they were very similar. And Hamilton, whom I adore, by the way, mm-hmm. and whom I'm actually very seriously considering working on as my next project.
You definitely should. He's a cutie. You've seen him on the $10 bill.
I have, but I'm told that he might not be on the $10 bill very much longer.
Not if I have anything to say about it. We're going to get rid of Andrew Jackson, but we're not going to get rid of...
I agree with you completely.
Okay, between the two of us, I think it's going to be our next cause. But that's a great subject, but very similar people, and both equally fascinating, each in his own way. But what you're telling me is that Lafayette did get those battlefield commands, and that he did become a good battlefield commander, but I'm guessing that that was not his most important contribution.
That's exactly right. So what actually ended up being his most important contribution was his role as I was saying earlier, as the real embodiment of French-American friendship. So what happened was when France signed the Treaty of Amity and Commerce with the United States and said that they were going to come out in open support of us, Lafayette
that, was that
actually...
Was that 78? Was it right after Saratoga, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, right. After we had a big victory up in upstate New York, and finally that the naysayers in France were finally convinced that we had a good chance of winning, and so they were comfortable backing us. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that's...
No, that's absolutely correct.
Okay. And so now we've got this friendship treaty, and what happens next?
And Lafayette decides that what he wants to do is he's going to go back to France. And he wants to come back to the United States. Now he wants to come back at the helm of the French forces. Now, what's interesting is that he is, of course, by now, let's see, it's 1778, so by now he's all of, 21.
Mm-hmm. and that, you know, my younger son is 21 years old, and he's a fantastic fellow. But the idea that young Ben Harris would be coming back, leading the French army across the Atlantic, does make me also a little bit... It's a surprising notion.
Exactly. But Lafayette was so convinced that he alone understood the Americans and that he alone had developed such a close relationship with Washington that he genuinely felt that he was the person who was best positioned to lead the French forces to help the United States to victory. Now, of course, the French government had some other ideas. And they essentially brokered a deal. They said, well, you know, we're going to send Rochambeau over because he's a bit more experienced. And Rochambeau, I mean, I'm understating this. Rochambeau was a tremendously accomplished mm-hmm. Officer. But what they said to Lafayette was, why don't you be the one to carry the news? So Lafayette returned to the United States carrying the news that Rochambeau and all of the French forces were coming in full swing. And he carried that news to Washington personally, and he carried it on a ship called the Hermione.
Mm-hmm.
And that ship, as you might know, is arrived at Yorktown, or a reconstruction of that ship has been in the works for the past 20 years almost. And it arrived in Yorktown, Virginia about 2 weeks ago, and it's now making its way up the East Coast. It's going to be here in New York next week, and it's going to keep on going up to Maine.
And I'm sure you'll see it when it's in New York, but you've already seen it.
I saw it in France. I saw it in Yorktown, and this week in Philadelphia. I'm actually going to have the good fortune to be on the ship with Lafayette and George Washington.
Or their modern incarnations.
Or their modern incarnations.
Indeed. In fact, those could be. You could just answer my question. Would they have let you, or did they let you actually sail on that ship across the ocean? Did you get to do that?
I did not get to do that. I'm not sure, to be honest. You know, even Lafayette, when he sailed across, not on the ship, but on the first voyage when he first came over in 1777, he found the crossing to be a bit difficult, and I think he said that the Atlantic actually, he said that the sea saddened him, because at the time, of course, the crossings took at least 6 weeks, often
right.
longer.
So you didn't want to get on the sailboat.
That's what I'm saying.
And you mentioned that the name of the ship is Hermione, but most Americans would pronounce that the Hermione.
Or, I guess that's right, Hermione. Hermione
in Harry Potter. Yep. Yeah, exactly. The same
exactly,
sort of thing.
Hermione, like Harry Potter.
Very right. Okay, so that's going up the coast here in the summer of 2015, and people can see it during this trip, and I hope people will go out and see it. That must be really cool.
It's pretty amazing, I have to say. So, yes, it arrived in Yorktown. It's now on its way to Philadelphia. Then it goes to, it'll be in New York. Then it goes to Greenport, Long Island, Newport, Rhode Island, Boston, and finally Castine, Maine on Bastille Day.
Oh, wow. Cool. Different revolution, but still cool. Okay, so Lafayette shows up. He brings the good news, and that's when they start laying the plans for Yorktown, right?
That's exactly right. And so he succeeds. He's very influential, as is Hamilton, honestly, at the Siege of Yorktown.
Hamilton finally got his command.
That's exactly right. And he's actually fighting with Lafayette at the Siege of Yorktown.
Right. And they had sort of like a rivalry there. And it's like he'd storm the ramparts and say, "Take that, Lafayette. I got here first."
Something to that effect. I think so. I think that's almost a direct quote.
These are young guys. These are guys in their early 20s out to prove themselves. And
that's exactly right.
And they're here in the full flush of battle. And, of course, to paraphrase somebody else, I think Winston Churchill later said, "There's nothing quite so stimulating as being shot at without result."
Exactly. I'm sure that being shot at with result is slightly less stimulating.
A little bit different, but I mean, that's also cool in its own way. As Lafayette had found out at Brandywine, getting wounded is nothing better because then you get to show your war wounds to all the girls later on. But in this particular case, they make it over the ramparts at Yorktown, each of them leading their forces. And so they get to share fully in the glory of this French-American victory.
That's exactly right. Now, here's where it becomes interesting, or here's where it becomes, for me, even more interesting,
mm-hmm.
is that so all of these thousands of Frenchmen who my curator friend was talking about, the thousands of names we don't know, well, most of them went back to whatever careers they had left behind. But as you'll remember, Lafayette had no career left behind. And so what happened was America actually became his career. In fact, I think it became more than his career. It became his identity. So that in the 1780s, Lafayette did everything that he could to advance the American cause in France. So, for example, he worked to help negotiate favorable trade agreements between France and America. He opened his home to Benjamin Franklin, to Thomas Jefferson, to John Adams, to Governor Morris. He had regular Monday night dinners in English where his children entertained the guests with American songs, and his children were named George Washington Lafayette, that's his son. And then he had a daughter whom he named Virginia,
mm-hmm.
or Virginie.
Mm-hmm.
And when he named his daughter Virginia, Benjamin Franklin famously quipped that he hoped that the Lafayettes would have 13 children, so they could name one of them for each of the colonies. And, in fact, there's another great anecdote from the American explorer John Ledyard, who was visiting France at the time, and he wrote that Lafayette has planted a tree in America, and he sits under its shade at Versailles. So it was only natural that when France started looking towards its own era of reform, which started really in the late 1780s, of course, culminated in 1789 with the storming of the Bastille, it was actually to Lafayette that Paris looked, because Lafayette had so identified himself with America, had so identified himself with Washington, that Paris looked to Lafayette as a man who would become the French Washington, as a man who they thought could lead his nation to a new era of liberty, just as Washington had done over here.
That seems natural. So they had a much more violent revolution than we did.
Well, that's the thing.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, they really had a revolution. I mean, many people have pointed out that we had kind of a secession.
I think that's absolutely correct.
And we didn't really overthrow it. We didn't march into London and put in a new government and get rid of King George III.
That's absolutely correct.
Okay. We seceded, and rule of law and the Hamilton perspective, all of that was extremely important. Certainly the American Revolution was violent, but it was not violent in the sense that people were being guillotined in the streets of London. That, unfortunately, is what happened, and I think that it was in that period afterward that that's when people really wanted Lafayette to come in and take charge and restore some order, right?
That's exactly right. And, of course, what ended up happening was that that turned out to be too big a job for any man.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was one guy who showed up a little later and was able to restore order.
Napoleon?
Yeah, that was a little bit later, and he was a very different sort of man.
And Lafayette and Napoleon did not get on very well at all.
I'm guessing that's true, yeah.
But another story entirely.
Uh-huh. So Lafayette shows up. He tries his best. He's not able to bring the Paris mobs under control. And so
what actually happens in 1789 is that Lafayette is his vision of what a new liberated France should be is actually not a republic. What he thinks that France should have is a constitutional monarchy, the kind that they have in England.
Mm-hmm.
So he wants reform, but he does not necessarily want revolution. Now, what ends up happening during the course of the French Revolution is that this middle ground position that he holds, the idea that France should reform its monarchy but not abolish it, this becomes something that leaves him standing almost completely alone.
Wow.
Because he loses the support of the absolute monarchists, the people who don't want to change at all. They early on lose faith in Lafayette. And then eventually he loses the support of the people because he does not believe that France should have a republic. And so he actually ends up fleeing the country in 1792. And it's one of these terrible ironies and tragedies. 1792, the radical Robespierre and the Jacobins are ascendant in Paris, and a call goes out for Lafayette's arrest. And if he had stayed in the nation, he would have been arrested and almost surely executed as an enemy of the revolution.
Isn't that remarkable? And this illustrates perfectly something I've long believed, and that is if you are a reasonable person who listens to both sides, who tries honestly to broker compromise, typically all that will happen is you'll make enemies of everyone.
And that's exactly what happened.
Mm-hmm.
So that he flees the country with a call for his arrest going out because he's an enemy of the revolution. He flees the country. He crosses over to Belgium, to the Austrian Netherlands, and he's promptly arrested as an enemy of the monarchy.
Oh, jeez. The guy can't win.
That's exactly right.
I'm guessing he's just exiled from this point forward for a long time.
Well, he spends 5 years in Austrian prisons. And finally is released in 1797, goes back to France in 1799, actually kind of uses the opportunity of Napoleon's coup d'etat to sneak back into France.
Mm-hmm.
But he never really regains his French popularity. So to this day, in fact, there are people on the right in France, monarchists, because monarchists still exist in France, who blame Lafayette for having started the revolution. And then there are people on the left who blame Lafayette for having hindered the revolution.
Good heavens. There are still monarchists in France.
There are.
So Lafayette is still getting blamed as being an enemy of the monarchy.
He is.
Okay,
and
now you're teaching me something here, Laura. I had no idea.
He is. And he is still getting blamed as well for being an enemy of the people.
Because he simply wanted reasonable reform along English lines.
Well, the actual event that that really damaged, I think, his reputation on the left in France was an event that happened on the Champ de Mars in 1791. The Champ de Mars is where the Eiffel Tower stands today.
Mm-hmm.
And 1791 in July, the monarchy had actually, the king and queen had attempted to flee the country. They had been arrested and brought back during a night that became known as the Flight to Varennes.
Mm-hmm.
And a month later, in July of 1791, a crowd was gathered on the Champ de Mars to declare the monarchy abdicated. They were there to sign a petition. Violence broke out. Martial law was declared. Lafayette was in charge of the French National Guard, and he and his soldiers were patrolling the perimeter. Rocks were thrown, shots were fired. Precisely what happened, we don't know. But what we do know is that the National Guard opened fire on the people.
Hmm.
And somewhere between 8 and 100 people were killed. We still don't know to this day because the records are such a contentious mess. But that event was known as the Massacre at the Champ de Mars, and there are people on the left in France today who blame Lafayette for having become an enemy of the people because his troops opened fire that day.
Oh, my. My, my. Well, so he comes back. He's still not welcome. How did he... I mean, he's still a young man at this point.
He's still a young man. He spends about 15 years, though, the whole Napoleonic era, largely in retirement. He actually becomes a farmer. He wants to emulate Washington to some extent, sort of to become like Cincinnatus,
mm-hmm.
the same way that Washington retired to Mount Vernon. Lafayette retires to his estate, devotes himself to farming, agriculture.
See, that's sort of surprising. Why would his estate still be there? Well, I would have figured that they, I mean, he's past the terror now. I mean, the terror is over with. But didn't they expropriate his estate? I mean, I'm surprised he's got any money to go back to.
He didn't have any. This was actually his wife's family's estate, and his wife's family was executed. His wife's sister, mother, and grandmother were all executed on the same day.
Well, this is a fascinating tale, and the tyranny of the clock tells me we're about to run out of time, so I'm sure we have skipped over all sorts of fascinating details, but you've already filled in, Laura, a great number of things about Lafayette that I did not really even know. And I'm just going to urge everyone to run out and buy 10 copies of your book. Just for the record, what is the actual title of the book?
The actual title of the book is The Marquis, Lafayette Reconsidered.
Reconsidered. And, of course, your name is Laura. And how do you spell your last name?
It's pronounced Auricchio, and it's spelled Auricchio.
All right. Now, we've given everyone just enough information that they can find this book on Amazon or preferably at their local bookstores. Any final thoughts before we sign off?
My only final thought is to thank you tremendously for the opportunity to talk about a subject about which clearly I feel maybe a bit too passionately.
Not in the least. Thank you for all of your hard work over the last 7 years. I know it must have been hard spending all that time in Paris.
Yeah, you get very little sympathy for that. It's true.
All right. And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Laura Auricchio, dean at the New School in New York City and author of the book, The Marquis, Lafayette Reconsidered. Go out and buy 10 copies. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineers are Chad Barrett and Bob Hoffman. Our Madison Minute is by the incomparable Jim Blaylock. We didn't have one of those today, but that's okay. Maybe next week. And, of course, our music is by the Fifes and Drums of Colonial Williamsburg. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.